Hello and welcome to the Product Breakfast Club podcast by AJ and Smart, where each episode we bring you a fresh and insightful chat between designer and co-founder of AJ and Smart, Jonathan Courtney, and Jake Knapp, the New York Times best-selling author of design process book Sprint. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. Jake has set it so that John gets a little electric shock each time you do. If you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, share, or comment. We love hearing your feedback.
Hello, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
And welcome to episode 2 of the Product Breakfast Club, a podcast which now has a name.
Nobody clap.
Nobody clap. We can clap. Yeah.
Jake will start blinking.
That's true. I blink when people clap. It's embarrassing.
It makes sense. So it's episode 2. We are here in sunny.
It is.
Or cloudy-ish.
Sunny-ish
California. Episode 1, we are on different time zones. Episode 2, we are sitting here in Jake's living room, which is very nice. And we're going to do the second episode of the podcast here. At breakfast time, at Jake's place. Let's do it.
It's going to be like the difference between The Phantom Menace and the second one, where the second one was like better than The Phantom Menace, but still pretty bad.
Actually, yeah. I mean, it's not going to be a good part. I think we're very clear on that. It's not going to be good. We think it's going to take about 5 to 10 episodes before this podcast is actually good. But if you're listening to this, and if you listen to the first one, then we're really happy that you're sticking with us. Let's do a little introduction round. I realized in the last episode that we just got right into it, assuming that everyone knows who we are. Assuming that, you know, they found the podcast because they know who we are, but you never know how people actually... So, let's do we also have a new person sitting here. So maybe let's just do a quick little round, introduction round, and also maybe let's say where you're from, because I'm sure people are going to be confused about the accents. Do you want to start, Mike?
No worries, yeah. Michael Smart here. Nice to meet you all. I'm from Australia. I don't have my barbecue with me right now, but if I'm not barbecuing, I'm working at AJ and Smart, designing products and services and helping people bring some good stuff to life.
Oh, I am I'm Jake, and I'm from Washington State in the United States of America. And I'm a designer and writer.
Nice. And I'm Jonathan from Ireland, and I don't have a job. I think actually they just hired me to do this sound.
We didn't hire you.
It's free. I did it for free.
You just turned up with those headphones.
I think it's because I have the headphones. That's the reason I've been allowed to host the podcast. I'm the same as Michael, basically. We're both co-founders of AJ and Smart and also product designer.
You didn't say where you're from.
I said it from Ireland.
It's like the one thing you said for us to say.
No, I said it. No, I think we may have proof here. Two microphones.
We'll find out. Backward scrubbing.
Exactly. It's also the first time we've done a podcast. The last time was the first time we've done a podcast in general, and now this is the first time we've kind of done it with three people. Obviously, everyone's supposed to be mic'd up, but we're just not that good yet, right? I think every episode is going to get better and better. We've got a couple of topics to go through, and we're going to try to keep this episode to 1 minute, 1 hour long. And just as a reminder, sometimes we'll be talking about things... where we'll accidentally talk about it as if we think you can see us. And that's because there's a YouTube version of this as well. So if you're listening to this on the podcasting app, whatever you're using, there's also a YouTube version if you want to see the things that we're describing sometimes, which happens. Okay, we'll try to avoid it.
Yeah.
And maybe we can help
each
other.
I won't make that mistake, but you were going to. I won't. I'll be fine.
So the first topic of today is the iPhone X. Every other podcast.
We don't have one.
We're a little bit late. I think we're like 5 weeks late to talk about it. Actually, maybe even 8 weeks.
This is we're late to talk about it, and we don't actually have one.
We don't have them here. That's the problem.
Well, it was a topic of conversation this morning because mine just shipped. I went to order it the first, you know, like I stayed up late to order it, and when it came out. And actually, for you, it's like in the morning when you can order it. Is that right?
Yeah.
For us, it's like 3 a.m. Even 6 or something.
Okay. Yeah. But I got it in the cart and everything. And then it was like, oh, do you want to pick it up in the store? And I was like, I don't know if I want to. because it was already sold out in San Francisco at like 12:03 a.m. And so I was like, oh, do I want to drive? And then I realized I don't drive, so I was going to have to ask my wife to drive me to pick it up. And then in that moment when I had those thoughts, it had sold out in every store in the vicinity of San Francisco.
You snooze, you lose, Jeff.
And so I had to, so then it was like already 2 to 3 weeks. So people are excited about the iPhone.
Yeah, right? For the first time in a long time, actually. Yeah, but that's actually an interesting...
previous
it's like almost a year ago the last time people were this excited about
I think that honestly people haven't been excited about the iPhone since the 6, like since they actually changed this to the larger screen size, and even then it was more like reluctant excitement because it actually didn't look that great. But this is like the first beautiful, fancy looking, kind of sexy iPhone that's come out
this
in a while.
Right, yesterday, weren't we, Mike? For me as well, the iPhone 4 was just like this perfection of
so beautiful
design. And now they've gotten back to this kind of glass on the back, right, which I'm quite happy about.
It's really nice. I mean, we're going to smash the shit out of it. It's going to be 100% broken within 10 minutes. But it doesn't matter because it only costs like $500 to repair the back glass.
Oh, that's nothing. Yeah, that's nothing.
It's easy.
Oh, good.
But actually, I think what's an interesting question would be, why is it that in our industry, if you look at the tech industry, if you look at, I know this is kind of generalizing it, but if you look at the bubble that we're in, why do so many people still buy iPhones when there's so much choice on the market? I mean, Google just released a huge amount of hardware. They just released their Pixel 2. I know it had like a lot of screen trouble, and I know it had a lot of kind of restrictions in terms of how much they could ship. But why is the iPhone still interesting? Like, why are you guys spending now, I guess, over $1,200 on an iPhone and not a cheaper Android device? Why? I'm curious.
Well, for me, it's partly important because I think it's like the device of record. And if I'm going to be in the know about what's going on in with products, and when I'm helping people with sprints, or whether I'm writing about how you can sort of adapt technology to not be too distracted, I feel like the iPhone is the device. It's the one that still people look to as the leader. And so partly it's important for that. But that's also my justification. I mean, the other part is I love the iPhone. I'm much more excited about the iPhone than I am about any other devices. I would never pick up I have never yet picked up another phone and thought, like, this is as cool. I have as much, like, lust in my heart for this thing as I do for an iPhone. So that's really fundamentally the driver, is that it's still the most exciting thing. I do think that there's this moment where, like, the iPhone now has no bezel, basically, right? Mm-hmm. Except the notch. And so there's like, it's basically just a screen. And increasingly over the next few years, it's just going to be about, like, the software and, like, how long the phone lasts. Like, the incremental new features have probably become less and less exciting, mm-hmm. you know, over the last few years. And the difference between the Pixel and the Pixel 2 is pretty remarkable. Whereas, like, the Pixel was... really just looked almost exactly like the iPhone 6. Mm. Pixel 2 is, you know, like, it's sort of a big step forward. And if you look at the history of Google-produced phones or Google partnership phones before then, like, they're catching up pretty fast. I still feel like there's all that stuff you mentioned, like, there's problems with the screen, or, like, there's all these things that you, when they make the announcement, you can almost anticipate, like, oh, God, there's what are going to be all the things that are going to come out that we're going to be
full of spiders.
It's full of spiders. Yeah. So I think that, you know, they're gaining super fast, but there's a long way to go to get this sort of level of polish and excitement and everything that the iPhone has. But the next few years, like, I don't know what's going to happen.
What do you mean that it's the phone of record? Like, what is that? You're saying that this is like the kind of, I don't know, prototypical phone where it's the target device that companies are designing for. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, nobody's ever going to... that I've seen is ever comparing, like, the new hot phone from Android, like whether it's a Google phone or whatever. Nobody's ever, like, not comparing that to the new iPhone. Like, you know, whereas, like, when you could talk about the iPhone, you could just talk about the iPhone and not compare it to other phones.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's ever not comparing another phone to the iPhone.
Do you think about that in terms of, let's say, like, you know, product design just going way back to, like, some classic, you know, transistor radios by Dieter Rams or something like that? Like, these reference.
Like, reference is a better word than of record. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I can see that for sure, right? That you actually just kind of, like, put it there and go, that was the phone in that year. Yeah. You don't need to kind of, like,
this is what phones looked like in 2017.
Yeah.
I think that the reason I'm kind of trapped to it, number one, is it is the nicest physical, like, in terms of just niceness. It's the nicest thing. And, and I think that one thing that I always find really interesting is that the internet always explodes when a new Apple device comes out because they complain about how expensive it is. And the whole, like, the news was going crazy that this thing was $1,000 or more than $1,000. But I knew that everybody I knew would still get it, and it didn't really matter because you're not buying these iPhones as a pragmatic, practical life choice. You're buying it because you're an idiot and you want to spend loads of money on something nice.
It's super dumb.
Yeah, like, it's so stupid.
I felt super dumb when I when I ordered it.
But people don't get it. Yeah, but people think that. Like, also with these MacBook Pros, they like people are like, yeah, it's like, look how expensive this thing is. No one's going to buy it. But for people who are kind of, you know, designers by trade and doing that every day, you're not going to buy the Dell that's like $700 cheaper just because it's cheaper. You want to also have the nice thing.
There's also this thing with, like, your when something goes wrong with it, I would be kicking myself if I had not gotten the Apple thing, because they've done such a good job historically with both the laptops and the phones and everything of, like, I always feel like they're the most likely to be the most reliable for the systems to work the best in general. And when you, you know, if you've ever had that experience of having, like, a laptop or phone or something goes wrong and you're just, like, kicking yourself because you're, you know, you're taking it back or whatever, like, I don't ever want to be in that situation.
Did you have to use an Android phone when you worked at Google, or were you allowed to use whatever you wanted?
You were allowed to use whatever you wanted, but I did at times have both, because they would like give you one. Yeah. And it's useful to see the difference for sure.
Yeah.
I like that you brought up, like, this kind of, like, this history of constantly proving themselves and the longevity of that product. If I think about, you know, I always kind of hand down my devices, let's say, to then my wife gets my old MacBook Pro, you know, for instance, and it's now getting up to maybe 7 or 8 years old, but it's still going. It might be kind of running an older version of the OS, but it's still more reliable than, like, getting a really cheap PC and then trying to get all of the million updates of Windows or something. And I think for me as well, this ecosystem, like, this real attention to detail, like, where, like, hardware and software comes together, it would be very hard for me to break out of this mold now, even if I'm using something like Google Mail or something, because we have that for our email. For me, still, this ecosystem thing is the reason to... it would be very hard for me to go out of this ecosystem.
Well, and honestly, the AirPods as well.
Yeah, the AirPods are really... Oh, man, yeah. They look so dorky, but they really are...
I think you got these on.
Yeah, well, you keep thinking that. But the other thing about the ecosystem thing is, like, if you are passing your devices on, and that's definitely something that happens with... Because they last, so you pass them on. Yeah. Then you're on the hook for tech support, right? Like, I mean, if you give them to your in-laws or whatever, like, you're going to be... You're the one who's responsible. And, like, I don't know. This whole thing about Google, they have this reputation for abandoning projects. Right. And I think it's, like, it's both, you know, they do. They do that sometimes. And so sometimes you'd wonder, like, okay, what's this going to look like in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years? But like, the headphones that can translate, like... I really doubt that works. I would use it all the time. I mean, with you two, I can't understand what you're saying half the time. I assume it has Australian and Irish to English, but that's, like, super interesting. I doubt it really works yet, but I think it's going to be amazing to see what Google's doing with the phones in 3 years and 5 years.
I think that Google gets, like, actually, maybe that's a question to the both of you. Google gets a lot of positive press when they release these things, and they get a lot of this sort of, you know, Google's the one that's making all these innovative products. Mm. They're the ones who are pushing the envelope, whereas Apple's boring.
It's like, you know what it is? It's like when you're a dad and you have kids and you, like, show up to any event at school, or, like, what people have such low expectations for dads that you're just like, you look like the best dad. Like, you do anything and they're like, oh, wow, what a great dad you are, you know? And, like, moms are just like... They have to do something unbelievable to get credit for being a mom, because people just have this expectation, well, of course the mom is gonna, you know,
be amazing.
Be amazing, yeah, of course, of course. And, like, for dad, you just, like, you crack open, like, a Dr. Seuss book and, like, you're Father of the Year. And that's, I feel like that's a little bit with Google. It's just like, that's look at that, like, wow, though. They, you know, if you can pick up the phone, it doesn't cut you. Like, good job, guys. You know, and, like, with Apple, it's just like, come on, impress me.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it. So, like, Google's the boring dad. Apple's the always like overdoing
our expectations for Google are pretty low with devices, right? So if they do anything good, I think people are like, oh, wow.
Because it's interesting, actually, on The Verge, the review of the Google Pixel 2 was talking about how pragmatic the device was. And they give it a very high score based on how pragmatic it was. If Apple releases something that's pragmatic or boring, they get slated. Right, they get destroyed. Right. It's like, it's the same thing as last year. It's boring. It's not exciting. This is like, they wouldn't use the word pragmatic. They'd use the word boring. But the Pixel 2 is like, this thing is pragmatic. It's pragmatic because, yeah, exactly. That's true. But like, why? Actually, that's
Pragmatic would be just like an old Nokia, right? You can call.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's well, I what guess, a phone should do.
Right? I think that the phone, the Pixel 2, is not fancy. Mm. It's not a fancy device. Especially the Pixel 2. Yeah. The Pixel 2 XL has the edge-to-edge screen, but the Pixel 2 itself still has the huge bezels. It still looks exactly like the Pixel 2 from last year. It doesn't have any like fancy materials. It's essentially the same phone as last year, but it's pragmatic. It's not boring, it's pragmatic. But why is it that, so do you think that one of the reasons that people hate on Apple, because actually if we talk to anybody, like when I'm in my friends group back in Berlin, or if I post something on Facebook about Apple, you just get attacked. It's like, Apple are dumb. They're just trying to steal your money. It's always assumed that they're up to something really bad. Like that Apple are like, oh, they're just trying to make you buy the dongle. As if Apple cares about like the margins on the revenue. Dongle. Like seriously, it's ridiculous. And you hear people like parents always saying, oh, Apple devices used to last forever, but now they break on purpose so that they have to charge you to repair them. As if a company like that would risk their reputation making these things break earlier. This, what is it called? Like built-in something.
Self-destruct.
Yeah. I think that
this message will self-destruct.
I think it's like somehow there's a lot of hate for Apple.
Gadget? I don't know. While we're on the dad trail, I didn't come.
Let's go on the dad trail. I think it's just there's a lot of hate around Apple because, like you said, they're so kind of popular. They're the number one.
They're fascinating. I mean, here we are talking about them for a really long time. I think that I always try to not talk about Apple because I think it's you know, everybody talks about Apple all the time. But they're fascinating because the rules for Apple are different than they are for other companies. And I think people try to, often when they're building products, they try to play by Apple's rules. You know, they say like, well, what did Apple do? Like, what did Steve Jobs do? Right? And it's like, it doesn't work for other companies. Right. And you can see from the outside when their products come out that the way we judge and evaluate them is different. And that is an interesting thing about the different, you know, the companies that are dominating in tech. If you look at like how people judge Amazon, it's really interesting. There's a totally different set of criteria for what a great Amazon product is. Mm. And we have all, you know, most of us are shopping sometime on Amazon and their website is like, you know, it's kind of janky and like you're trying to figure out where stuff is and like how it works. But it's extremely effective, but it's not the same kind of product. It's not the same kind of product design or quality or marketing that we expect from Apple, and it's different. There's also different standards for Google. There are different standards for Facebook. We just have different ways of judging these different companies, just like we have different ways of judging almost people we know. And
I judge everyone the same.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm really nice. I'm just going to press this button here on this laptop.
Start recording.
It's recording. I just want to make sure because this stupid Apple device is after.
I'm wondering if there is something at the heart of that. Like when you build a product, right, you're always kind of saying, you know, you need to, like, what is the user expectation? What does he want to do by using this tool, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Apple made kind of famous, like, it just works, right? And the same with Amazon. It's like, you go on this crappy looking website, you get thrown into like checkout processes, you click on one thing, it looks totally different because they're trying something else out over here. Yeah. But you go through it and you get your stuff, basically. Yeah. If not, well, you're in the States, so you get it pretty quick. So for us, it's like you might get it within a day, let's say. But you get what you want, right? You turned up with this expectation. Do you think that still like this at the current, at the like the heart of designing products or services is, you know, a key to having success?
Yeah, that is the heart. And for most of us who are not working at one of those companies, that's fundamentally what's going on. But it's really easy to get caught up in the Excuse me, I was eating toast earlier because this is the
breakfast podcast. It was damn good raisin toast.
It was really good. Yeah, almond butter.
Crazy Americans baked here at
Castle
Mac. Yeah, Holly baked it. This is an example.
Who's Holly?
Holly's my wife, and she baked the bread, and she gets no credit for baking the bread because she's a mom.
Whereas I think the bread just appeared.
Yeah, I think if I baked the bread, people would be like, "You are me." Like, they couldn't believe it. But
you are actually
because
Jesus.
It is fantastic bread. And,
well, we want to say thank you for the hospitality, Holly.
Thanks, Holly.
She's not going to listen to this.
Letting us stay here and baking the bread.
There's no way she got through the apple part.
Yeah. So let's finish it up. But it kind of opened up a question about Amazon as well. Like, so one of the reasons I think that people dislike Apple or why the press really loves to crap all over them is that Apple as a company is very patient and confident in what they're doing, and they make long-term moves that don't make sense until you see them in hindsight. So they, for example, will remove something from a device, right? They'll remove something from a device and everyone will freak out. They'll be like, we're removing these 10 ports, but it might not make sense in the current moment. They, like Apple calls it courage. They're like, we courageously move the dongle. But in hindsight, when you look back, like, for example, at the headphone jack situation, they were the first company to remove that from the phone, at least first mainstream company.
Yeah.
Everybody freaked the hell out.
Yeah. Google, and it was a feature last year. It was like a feature on the Pixel, like, oh, well, we have a headphone jack.
Yeah.
this year, not talking about it so much.
This year, soon as any company wants to do an edge-to-edge screen, they're like, oh, yeah, we have to remove the headphone jack. And people are like, yeah, it's fine. Obviously, that's totally not a problem. And I think that the Apple just, it's not this courage thing. It's just that they're willing to release things where, and they're so secretive they don't tell you why they've done this thing.
Yeah.
So they kind of bring things out bit by bit, and it's hard to see what they've done until you see it, like until you kind of have this hindsight view.
Yeah, all of these companies are playing a different game than most of us are playing when we look at it. And Apple's playing a game where they have a ton of money. They know they know what they're doing. Everyone there is like, you know, extremely talented, extremely skilled, but they also have this track record in history, and they know when they do this kind of thing, we're going to get this kind of blowback from it, and then ultimately people won't care.
Mm. Yeah.
And the same is true for, you know, all these really big successful companies that everybody looks at. They're playing a different game than everybody else, and you can't just look at what they're doing and try to like replicate it.
Yeah.
You have to try to go deeper into like the heart of, as Michael said, like what are they trying to deliver to the customer? What's the key question that they're trying to ask each time and answer when they come out with a new phone? And you know, with the iPhone, I think it's kind of been a question of like, will people be okay with face recognition? Like, are people going to be comfortable with that? They obviously put a lot of thought into the way they talked about that, the way they explained that. And that's like almost a smaller feature when you think about the phone. I think everybody thinks about the design of it. That's what excited me about it. Part of what makes that design work is not having the button, not having the fingerprint scanner. And they had to, in order to get that to work, kind of the linchpin moment was that people would buy into the Face ID.
Yep.
And so if you're a company looking at the launch of the iPhone, that might be the thing that's the most interesting to look at, is how did Apple sell and explain the face recognition, which is almost the scariest, weirdest, most likely to be, you know, sort of anxiety producing part of that whole device. What did they do to make people feel comfortable about that?
But I love that about, because this is a topic that John was thinking that we might talk about, you know, like this upfront research. I mean, everyone could like talk about this just as like this nerdy feature because we can. But if you just kind of look at the way you use your phone, it just really makes sense. Like, I have to pick up the phone and I have to do this, and then I've got to position it. Like, it's trying to get these like latent needs. Like, they've discovered this latent need. It's like, okay, well, you know, just getting into it and making it even more secure and using this kind of technology to really, I don't know, enhance the experience, right, somehow. Because that is, okay, it's a tiny little gesture there, and that I'm in now, but as well, like, more protective is just this being able to glance at it and it knows and it's on, and I can, you know, save this 3 seconds or 3 microseconds or something. So it's really interesting because of like discovering these latent needs, and then, like you say, like telling that story that this is not just a piece of tech, we've done it for a certain reason, for this experience.
mute.
Yeah. Yeah, but every time they, you know, as a company and you're coming off a new product, if it's interesting, there's going to be something where you have to educate people and maybe break down their resistances to something new, like the headphone jack was sort of the big thing with the iPhone 7. But I think that this thing of, you know, whether it's face recognition or whether it's, you know, Alexa, like listening to you, or whenever I saw when we were working with startups and they were trying to come out with something new, what got interesting was, here's this new way of thinking about something. Right. We need to explain to you how it's going to work. And you've got to understand that story and you've got to like believe in it and have enough confidence in it and excitement about it or whatever, that you're going to try to do things in this different way. Mm-hmm. And that always is interesting to me, to see how companies do that. I mean, over time, they're just like breaking down all our resistances to everything so that the machines can take over and they can just suck our time and money right out of us. Yeah. And they're doing a great job just year by year doing that.
I think actually really interesting thing that came up there, by the way, anyone listening to the podcast now will notice that the sound has improved because I've raised the mic. But
so from episode one, like reducing books really to episode two,
first five episodes nightmare with the audio. I think that's what's really interesting. If you guys listen to last week's episode, we talked about this innovation fetish, that innovation always has to be about newness, it has to always be about like change and excitement. And I think one thing I saw really interesting, somebody, I can't remember the guy's name, I think it was Steven Sanofsky on Twitter, he posted that he bought the iPhone 10, that it was beautiful, that he really enjoys it, and Face ID is great. You can probably guess what people posted underneath that. Samsung already invented Face ID. It was already in the Samsung Galaxy One in the 80s. And actually, this is something that is a consistent point when I'm talking to a friend of mine called Eric, who I hope doesn't listen to this because I'm going to talk about him now. But he likes to bring up the fact that Apple didn't invent that thing, right? That it was in something else a long time ago. But the point is actually not about who invented it. It's about who made it mainstream, who made the mainstream comfortable with that feature. And I think that's something that people also love to ignore just for the outrage almost. They like to, because innovation is about newness, it's not about the execution, back to last week again, people ignore the fact that what Apple has done now with the Face ID and what they did with the Touch ID was also make the mainstream consumer comfortable with something that was kind of maybe nerdy or finicky. And I think they actually, to a lesser extent, did the same with the watch. The watch was like an extreme nerd thing. Like to have like a some sort of smartwatch was just like in the nerd culture, in basements, on Kickstarter. And now you see a lot, like, okay, now people can attack me on Twitter about this because it wasn't as successful as Apple hoped. But you do see quite a lot of people from a very diverse group wearing the Apple Watch. And it's something, and I think with the AirPods, it's the ultimate example where you just look around and so many people are wearing these things that 1 year ago were the nerdiest thing imaginable. Who would have thought that wireless Bluetooth headsets would come back in a strong way? And Apple, it's not that they in any way invented it. They just made it a little bit better, executed it well, and then also advertised it well in a way that it doesn't feel nerdy. Like, I think that the watch advertising focusing first purely on fashion and in no way on technology was great. And I think that that's like maybe to put a little period on this conversation about the iPhone, I think what's interesting is that people enjoy attacking Apple because they do things that are perceived as boring and perceived as catching up, but they execute extremely well to the point that people like us still want to buy their products, right? We know that they carefully and slowly worked to create this thing, even if often the software is kind of a bit janky, but we know that you can kind of trust that they know what they're doing in the long term, as opposed to these fun little experiments that Samsung does, like Bixby or something. Do you know Bixby?
No.
It's a dog with shoes. It's literally a button on the new Samsung phone, Galaxy S1000, I can't remember the name of it. It's a button that you squeeze on the right-hand side and this dog with shoes comes out. And it's like Siri, except if Siri was a dog with shoes.
Wow.
It's amazing.
That sounds pretty great.
I really like dogs. Okay, maybe we can move on to, or maybe we can actually...
Let's spend the next half hour talking about Bixby.
Yeah, I'm surprised you guys don't know about Bixby. It's a nightmare. It's a really bad product. But that's also another thing where people really love to talk about Samsung and how, in, like, you know, how innovative they are, and they have made.
And they are.
They are very. I mean, did you see their fridge?
No.
It can. It has a screen on the outside.
Oh, that's yeah. That's. I mean, that's amazing.
Do you actually want to make an argument for the fact that Samsung are
innovative?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are a lot of companies who are trying new stuff a lot of the time. And I think somebody like Apple, and I think Google has gotten better at this, and you know, some of this, like Facebook has gotten better at this over time. Google or Apple will like just look around, and they, when they like let somebody else come up with the thing and come up with their, you know, sort of prove out that the technology is viable, and then say like, okay, we can do that like 1,000% better. We'll just focus on that one little thing. Right. We'll really take our time and like craft it and make it work really well. But, and then we'll call it new. And like some number of people are going to get outraged that it's not actually brand new. But the reality is it's much harder to make that little thing. It's a lot of hard work to take some new technology and like bring it to market. But it's way more work, I think, to pick the ones that haven't hit yet but actually have the potential, and then deliver them in a way that's appealing to people, and that, you know, that people are going to love and fit into their lives. And I do think Samsung comes up with a lot of new interesting stuff, you know, but it's that same thing where we talk about like other phones versus the iPhone, where you're just kind of confident that Apple's already picked the winners of those features and that they've invested in making them like really, really good. And it's not going to have all of the stuff, but the stuff that's on there is probably mostly going to work.
What would you recommend for a company that isn't Apple, Samsung, or Amazon, but rather like a, let's say, large, older corporation who's looking to these companies to, you know, and they want to be them. They want to innovate like them. They want to get the press that they get. Which direction would you recommend them going in, having this Samsung approach where they kind of really do try to generate new ideas and bring new technology to the market, or this waiting around approach and trying to execute things in a very kind of slow and patient way? Does there need to be some sort of a balance there? Because when we speak to companies, there definitely is there's a taking sides on that approach.
Well, it's, you know, Samsung, we might be here, we're here talking about like the iPhone 10, and we're like three designers, like we're dorks, like the reality
is gonna be listening to the show.
Yeah, Samsung's a super successful company.
Yes,
like anyone would do really well to be like a fraction as successful as Samsung for a long period of time, continually coming up with good products.
Right.
They're partners with Apple. They're like producing the screens of the iPhone, right? Like Samsung's awesome.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that you should be like, oh, well, like, look, Apple's really like got it figured out. Samsung might be around after Apple has started to decline, and they may be still kind of at this super high level that they're at now. Who knows? Like, I don't think that you can say one way or another is better, but you do have to really be analytical about what challenge you're trying to solve right now and who has done that well, because it's really easy to look at the highly polished products that are out in the world with Apple and to discount, like, oh my God, they had this really like genius leader for, you know, like decades. Phil Schiller.
Phil Schiller.
Yeah.
He's still there, by the way.
There are things that are going on in Apple that you just can't reproduce. You can't just like go and like reproduce what they're doing. And I think that the one thing that people should pay a ton of attention to with Apple that they usually don't is their marketing. Their marketing is amazing. Yeah. It's so good. The telling of the story of the products is so good. And that's something every company can learn from. It's very few companies, when they look at Apple, think about, how are they marketing this? They think about, oh, Johnny Ive. They think about, like, I'm going to be an executive like Steve Jobs. I'm going to make these, like, screw, I have the vision. Like, you probably aren't as good as Steve Jobs. Like, I almost guarantee you, you're not.
Right.
But you can learn a lot from the way they marketed things.
Yeah.
And that engine, like, you can build that kind of thing at a lot of companies. And it forces you, if you start thinking about the marketing in the moment when you're telling the story of the product, it forces you in the beginning to think in a way that is very much like, okay, what does our customer want? How are we going to tell the story of this thing to the customer? And then all of a sudden, like, that's the thing that most other companies don't do so well. They're figuring it out at the end.
Yeah. What do you think about, if you're bringing up Steve Jobs kind of as this, you know, visionary leader, do you think
that, this is the worst that we're in a design podcast?
Yeah, I know.
It's a nice,
are talking
about Steve Jobs. Like,
let's move. I'll make the question kind of not as boring as you'll expect. Maybe it's a bit boring. There's a little crackle for anyone listening to this podcast and can hear a crackle every so often. I'm not sure why it's happening, but every so often I'm hearing a light, low crackle. I'm hoping it's the headphone jack. Damn you, Apple! It's not even an Apple product. So do you, like, just maybe a question to finish, really finish up the Apple conversation.
You said that 10 minutes How important
is it? I mean, that's something we can kind of all have a go at. How important is leadership from a design point of view and innovation point of view? Is it something that really can be recreated by just teams and kind of a, let's say, a democratic flat approach? Or does there need to be, or is it proven that there are, you know, having a strong leader or having some sort of strength in the leadership positions is important for design, for innovation? I mean, if you look at these companies like Amazon and Apple, Apple used to have a very strong leader. Amazon has Jeff Bezos, who's like this muscle beast running around punching people. Is that something important, or is it something that's just like a nice to have?
I think that design leadership is really important, but I think there's a lot of ways that you get good design and good product outcomes that aren't always necessarily with a genius visionary designer. And it's like, I know very little about what goes on inside Apple. I know like a couple of people who work there, and they're really smart. And I think they're like, from everything I can tell, they're probably really good at their jobs. They're super secretive about what goes on in Apple, right? Like who knows how they're making product decisions and everything. We assume it's very top down. I know that top down thing doesn't work in most company cultures. So you look inside a lot of companies who are making great products, and they're doing it in different ways than Apple does it. And there are not an unlimited number of brilliant visionary design leaders around who can, you know, manage a team of designers and sort of act as executives. And so a lot of companies are coming up with great products without that. They have a culture of design. And I think Apple probably has both great leaders as well as a culture that values design and where people feel like that's of primary importance, and the engineers agree and the marketers agree and sort of everyone agrees. That kind of thing, that culture of design, is something you can create without having found this perfect, amazing like prophet to lead you. And that's, I think, something that when we talk about design sprints, we're talking about like a way to start everything you do with a culture of design, with a way of thinking like, what's going to matter to our customers? What kind of a product can we make that's going to actually fit into people's lives? And you can actually start to create that culture even, you know, with something as simple as a process like that. But it goes, honestly, a lot further than that, and I'm not an expert. So let's go on to the next
topic. Okay, next topic. I think you actually kind of made a nice segue into the next topic. The next topic is sort of, it's basically about what do we think makes a good design team, like a successful design. Let's just focus on product design. I think we've all seen like hundreds of different product design teams in different companies at this point. We've seen successful ones who are consistently bringing good products to the market. We've seen maybe less successful ones who often end up getting trapped and going in circles and people leaving and getting rehired and all this kind of stuff. What do we think is like a... Maybe the first question is, what does a successful product team look like? And how do you actually create one in a company? How do you create a company that has a, you know, high chance of creating successful product teams? And go! Simple question.
Wow.
Simple question.
Yeah. Well, I'll start with a disclaimer, which is that I don't know much about managing or building product teams. I've sought in my career to avoid situations where I had to manage.
But you've
or hire
seen
alone.
Them.
Wolf.
Yeah. You've seen them. You've seen product teams like or people working together in a product team where you could say, okay, this team has something interesting.
Yeah, and I think that part of what's been common among teams that are performing really well is that if you have a tailwind of like, we have a successful business on our hands, we have product market fit, we're working on something that we're just starting out, but we're working on something we're all really excited about. That solves a lot of the problems that that can crop up. It's just like on a sports team. Like you rarely see unhappy, like super successful sports teams like leading their league or winning the championship and just having like tons of internal strife. Like that doesn't really usually happen. If you're winning, you're happy. And if you're winning when you're building products, like that will solve a lot of problems. So it's important to remember that when you look at like, oh, you know, company A like has this culture, company B treats their employees like garbage, but everybody seems happy and like they still are working there and they're still attracting good people. Well, like if they're both successful, that can explain a lot of it, because it feels good to work on something that's successful, and that, you know, that just sort of makes things, it kind of fixes a lot of problems. I think that the real question is like, where is it fun to work? And if you're on the bubble, if you're like, especially if you're starting something new, whether it's a new venture at a big company or it's starting something from scratch, how do you create a culture that people want to be a part of, where you can attract sort of the best people, you can get people who will be able to help you deliver that vision? How do you create that when you don't already have momentum? And actually, I would turn the question around to you two, because you've gone in the last few years from like the two of you to having this really growing team that's really well respected, and people are clamoring to work there. I hear from people who are like, how can I get an internship or work at AJ and Smart? So what did you do to kind of go from the two of you to building momentum and having a sort of a positive culture?
Cloning.
Yeah.
I mean, it was.
Samsung started cloning in the 80s.
I know. Samsung started before us. I think that at least for us, so essentially what we have within AJ and Smart is two product teams, like two relatively high quality product teams that are able to pump out very often successful products. But I wish the answer was that we had this formula and it was super easy. But the answer is actually, it's heavily reliant on the kind of people you hire. And I think that for us, it meant that we have grown very slowly over the last 6 years. We've hired people very slowly. We've hired people for roles that they didn't fit into and ended up fitting into something else very much more easy. And I think that just the flexibility that we have within the design teams for people to switch roles that they're more comfortable with, and also exposing people to every single part of the process, including the business side of the products. I think that's really, really at least for us, when we figure out like this team is starting to work really well, it's usually a team that doesn't just understand here's how you like, you know, nail the UX and UI side of it, but also here's how we align the UX and UI and design and everything we do with the business needs of this company. So I think that one problem that I see within teams, within agencies or companies, is when the design team is considered a resource that can be tapped into to produce things rather than having a seat at the table in terms of strategy for the overall product. And I think that successful teams, if you look at companies like Airbnb, which has a very successful design team, and it's very, you know, people want to work there. And you hear a lot about it. They also produce a lot of really interesting tools for the design industry at large. They're very involved in product decisions that are usually coming from top down, where it's like, okay, we want to do this thing now. The design team is heavily involved in that. Where the same thing is with Spotify, where the design team is not considered to be this resource like marketing or sales that the top management taps into, but they become part of the overall system. And I think that for us, I guess that it's a little bit easier to connect the design team with the business side of it, but it took us,
Because design is your business?
Yeah, because design is your business. But actually at the first few years, we did it the traditional and I would say wrong way, where myself and Michael as the founders used to go and visit the companies. Yeah. We used to listen to their business problems. We used to write it down. And then we used to come back to the office and pass that to the designers to produce the result. And this ended up in worse products. It ended up in way more misalignment. Overall, people being unsatisfied and just not as excited because they had no ownership of the sort of strategic decisions that we were talking about. Whereas now, every single, like each client gets its own product team from our side that they work with for 1 week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks in the design sprint process. And even the person who's just involved in user testing or the person who's just going to be doing the prototype is sitting with the CEO of this company with me, with someone else, and they're hearing directly from the source what is the strategy, what is the reason we're creating this thing. And I think that that has definitely helped make the teams more... Yeah, it's not just about production anymore. They feel like they have some ownership over the direction of the company, of the direction of the product that they're working on. And I think that in companies I've worked at before starting AJ and Smart, where the decisions would kind of come out of nowhere, and like the briefs would appear from thin air, or someone would come down from the tower and say, here's what we have to do, but with zero context, you generally had this like discontent within the teams. Because people didn't know, we didn't know why we were creating this product. We didn't know what we were supposed to do. We just knew we had to make something that somehow is like Skype, but with a Tinder-like interface. But we didn't really get, like, you didn't have the context of where that came from. And the person you would ask, maybe the creative director, they may not be able to explain to you the way their superior explained to them what they want. You'd be working on something for 6 months and then you finally present it back to the superior and they just say, no, that's not what I was talking about. And I think this starts to break down the design teams and kind of kill the motivation and the momentum. And you hear that a lot from even some of the big companies here in Silicon Valley, where you're talking to a design team and they're saying, yeah, sometimes it's really nice working there, but I've had like the last year, there's been so many changes from the top, which we don't really understand, that stuff is just getting scrapped the whole time. And what happens is those people then start to leave, and then you start to, the team starts, you have a high turnover, which results in a team that's not really well oiled.
Yeah, that can work. That kind of compartmentalized approach can work for a while if you happen to have product market fit, if you're working on something that turns out people want, which, you know, a big portion of that is luck. You come across the right idea and you're executing it at the right time and whatever, but it's not for the long term going to be sustainable, and it's going to be, you will over time lose people if your culture is top down, because it's not as fun, and many places are adapting their culture to find ways for everybody to contribute, to feel like they have ownership over something, and feeling like you have ownership over what you do, like that's a big deal, right? Yeah. That's fun.
Yeah, I wonder if it's about, I mean, ownership is great, but I also think you need, and teams, people in teams need this almost recognition for their work, right? You know, for the effort that they're putting in. And I don't mean like recognition internally, although that's a big point, right? Internally, that you get your work gets seen. I think that, and this is something that the sprint process really enables for teams, is that your work gets put in front of your end customer in whatever state it is, right? It doesn't have to be, you don't have to wait till it's released, because, you know, except for these huge companies or companies that really, you know, are in the business of getting stuff out in the market, which is just a hard thing to do. Product and design teams then just don't get this kind of feedback from their customers that what they're doing is any good.
Yeah.
So when you work and when you start to work in like it's a sprint process, for instance, and you're actually like forced to put your work in front of the customers all the time, I think that this is where designers and, let's say, creative problem solvers get a lot of energy and a lot of kind of, okay, we didn't get it quite right now, but we've reduced this kind of like fear of being wrong. So we know that we can have another crack at it next week, for instance, you know, if you're working in a sprint methodology, or you know you've got a sprint coming up where you could just have a crack at maybe just tackling that problem a little bit differently than you've done it before. And you're not going to get this kind of, okay, released it, nothing really worked, you're all fired, next team comes in, right? I mean, if you just build in that culture where it's, and I mean, this is something where you can, I mean, we were talking about Apple and Google and things like that, right? Then we have like the Google Wallet, and we have so many projects, right? And they're just testing all these things out. I don't know if those teams like got fired or they got moved on. Like, they're all amazing designers, right? I imagine. So I think you have to, as well as hiring great people, then you have to like make sure that you're working in a way that gives your designers this constant feedback. You can't give that internally, because it's not really worth as much as putting it in front of the customer and having this real feedback on the work you've done.
Yeah, I think that that's like something we call project fatigue as well, where when we used to work in the kind of the way that we used to work a few years ago, some projects would go on for 1 year, some projects would go on for 8 months, some projects would go on for 2 years. and it felt like they would never end. And you sort of get into this funk of working on something that you have absolutely, you have no milestones where it's like, yes, we completed that thing. Yes, we completed that thing.
Or the milestones were built up too much. I remember, you know, you'd have projects like, well, we're going to put this into user testing. And it was this big deal.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like, whoa, we're going to get 70 people and we're all building up to this huge momentous. And everyone had this like air of, we're going to succeed. Or it was almost like you could turn this feedback any way you want it to make sure that whatever you've designed up to this point definitely gets the tick from the customers, because the team just want to get it out there right now, right? But like breaking down these milestones and like constantly having this like almost check-ins with your customers, I think that this like stops the project fatigue, and it just stops this kind of like, you know, people, they've worked on something emotionally and they put all their sweat and hours into something, they're not likely to let go of it very easily, right? And so these milestones that we were always building up to were so huge that it was felt like we got to this point and the feedback was maybe like, meh, maybe it wasn't the best thing. And you're just like, all right, you know what? 3 months up, let's just move on, right? You know, like the team just felt like, I don't want to work on this. This is... hack it and get it out the door somehow.
Well, I do think... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say to... to bring it full circle back to Apple, I think that Apple, when they produce a product, they have to work for months and years to get the quality up to what it takes for it to be an Apple product that launches. And many products are like that. You have to spend a long time in the tunnel, you know, and you've committed to doing this thing, to doing it this way. You're in the tunnel and you've got to execute on it. And it's not productive for you, and sometimes in the middle of that tunnel, to stop and check in with your customers. But you, before you get in that tunnel, you need to have confidence that you're going in the right direction. Yeah. And Apple has a track record of having that confidence. Yeah. They know that when they build a high quality product, people will react well. If you work at Apple on the iPhone, if you work on whatever thing, like, you know, you can look out in the world and you can see the feedback that what you're doing has an effect on other people, that people care about it, that they value it. Yeah. Everybody's using those devices. And that's true at many big companies. You can look out there and say, the evidence is there. I know that people care about this. But for most of us, again, we're not in that situation. We're not building something where we know there's an audience of like Apple fans just like hungrily waiting for our polished thing to come out there. Yeah. So how do you have that confidence to get in the tunnel? And I think the design sprint is a way to give you that confidence in the beginning. If you're working on something where, you know, maybe that's not enough at the beginning, I think that idea of checking in partway through can be really helpful. And just because maybe Apple doesn't have to do it. And although I should mention, Apple actually ran a design sprint, I know, because they asked questions on one of the Medium posts. Yeah. So even they maybe sometimes want a boost of confidence. But it's really nice to know that you're on the right track before you do that hard work. So it's not to say that putting on the blinders and getting, you know, just getting heads down and like executing isn't super important. It is, if you want to make something high quality, you've got to do it. But you've got to really believe when you go into work and spend time, you know, spend your time of your life working on something that it matters. And you know, you can force people to do it by, you know, like from the top down, we're going to sort of force you, but over time you're going to, those kind of companies are going to lose out to ones that can inspire people.
I always feel like people in those teams look at the end result as a compromise. You know, it's like we got it out there and, you know, it went okay and we have a big brand, so of course it kind of, you know, we sold X, like the volume was there. But if you kind of chat then to the product team, or then you're working with that team in the next project, and the feedback is, well, we don't want it like last time where it was just like this design by committee, this like full of compromises. We just like basically the marketing team told us what had to go out. You know, I wonder if there could have been a different way. Well, I believe there is a different way. Like working the way that the team works then is, you know, is ultimately like their own satisfaction, regardless of what the business tries to get out of it. It's like keeping that team together has got to be more valuable for the organization somehow.
I think that, I mean, this is, it's kind of, whenever we mention design sprints, I kind of laugh a little bit because I guess people listening to this podcast are going to be thinking we're trying to be selling your book. Or something. We don't, well, personally,
maybe this is a good time to show the original jacket. I don't know.
Let's show that in a minute. But I think that like, just for transparency, we don't really give a crap whether you buy his book or not. I think that it's just like, it's an interesting topic because we've seen like what you could call mediocre design teams, at least when we've kind of come into companies where you could say that these people...
Were you the mediocre design team?
Yeah, we're the mediocre design
team. Bring us in, we're the mediocre design team.
But we've seen teams without strong leadership, without necessarily strong designers being able to release pretty good products just by plugging into a system that allows them to be a bit more part of the strategic decisions. And the part about the design sprint that I think that makes that work is that the designers get to sit in a room at the start of these projects with the leadership who are involved in the big decisions.
Yeah.
And I think that that makes it a huge difference. And I think it's a huge difference that the leadership also gets to have the perspective of what design is in the company and what it means, rather than this approach of the design team are a service that we have within the company, the same as the, I don't know, people who clean the bathrooms, or the same as the people who, I don't know, change the light bulbs. We also have the design team who can also just do stuff for us when we have our whim. I think I made a bad example there, but you know what I mean. It's just the designer is changing all the light bulbs in the office every week.
That's really...
And I think that this, like, this approach of building respect on both sides from the design perspective, because it's not just, actually I should say that designers are sometimes assholes and you they're also divas, and a lot of designers I talk to are like, oh yeah, the management are idiots, the product managers don't know anything, they're so stupid, everyone's stupid. And this sort of attitude is built up because the company has this toxic approach to designing products and building products, and because the designers feel like they're treated like, you know, workers, and whereas the management are like creating the blueprint and kind of pushing this stuff down on them. And I think you can get to a point using sprints, at least at the start of projects, where even if the management completely changes their mind 6 months down the line and like says, oh well, actually it turns out we want to have a hamburger menu right in the center of the screen, there's still an understanding where this compromise doesn't feel like such a nightmare, because the different departments actually understand exactly. Yeah. And I think that this is, at least for me, this discontent between design teams and other departments, especially design and marketing. This is a serious problem in a lot of companies where design and marketing have a lot of fights. And even design and development, where there's a lot of kind of anger between these teams, I think that can just tear a company's entire product processes apart, and their output is just going to be worse when these people are all fighting with each other. And what happens is that people just start giving up, and the compromise, they just start letting the compromises happen, even though they're just like, yeah, this is going to be a terrible product. And we know, we've spoken to a lot of people and companies who are building multi-million dollar products, where every single person on the team you talk to says, yeah, this is going to suck. So, and we say, yeah, well, why are you working on it? And they're like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't care anymore. This is just my job now, you know? And this is just ridiculous. It's insane.
And that's interesting when you put this, like, because you mentioned about also like the system and the way in which these designers are going to work, almost like this plug and play, especially with something like a sprint, right? That you can kind
buy
of
the book.
The subliminal message. But I mean, you know, designers get trained all different kinds of ways, right? And they have different backgrounds and all of these things. But when they then come together and try to work on that specific problem together, if there's no clear way that they're going to do it, like that, the how we're going to do it. I remember even when we also didn't have like a clear way, so
no,
we can like
make it up,
we can do
time.
Some sketches here, and we might go and look at some research over there that is there, or what's our favorite app over here. You know, there was just no clear way how we're going to actually set about tackling this problem together as a team, right? And I think that that's one huge thing for that, you know, companies or, you know, and teams trying to like make sure that their teams are working well together is, just make it really explicit about how, it doesn't have to be a sprint, it doesn't have to, just make it explicit about how you are going to set about solving that problem. Because that, you know, designers also, for even all of their bravado and all of their, let's say, arrogance maybe that comes out, they're going through like millions of little tiny, like anxious decisions, you know, in their head. They're not like, you know, quite maybe an insecure bunch of people as well, right? Because there's lots of different ways you could solve a given problem, right? It's not just like, you know, maybe there's like in medicine,
Oh, that's our 1 hour. Yeah. we can go for a few minutes more.
It's like maybe this kind of like trial by error thing, you know, where you're just crossing it down until you're down left to the one
yeah.
way that it can only be that one way. But I, you know, the success of product teams is not even really about that. For me, it's just like making sure that it's clear how we're going to work together.
Yeah. But how often do we meet designers who are satisfied with the product team they're working in? It's rare. It's actually very rare.
I wonder, you know, because you have like freelancers, you know, just like get plugged in.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love that we were also started out as freelancers or yeah. at some point go to freelance because you love this freedom, you know, of doing it my way. But, you know, still, like, you would have to have your own internal process that you would like to work in.
I think you can create, I'm sure you guys have seen it in the context of a sprint where a team who may not be loving each other comes together.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm an expert on the whole product process.
Yeah.
I've been through it. I have been through it a number of times. No, you guys have been through it a number of times. Sure. But where the three of us have seen a lot of reps is in the beginning.
Right.
We've had a chance to see and experiment with how you start a project hundreds of times,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so me seeing the product process all the way through, like maybe 10 or 15 times, mm-hmm. it's a lot when you think of products that took like maybe a year to mm-hmm. build. That's a lot of years, but mm-hmm. it's not a lot of reps compared to the beginning of processes and what I've seen in sprints. And when you, in a design sprint, what I always wanted to do was create a situation where the team, like what Jonathan said, the team, the leadership sees a lot of different choices. That's a recipe for a successful product when they have a lot of different options to choose from. And again, to go back to the iPhone, like one thing that inspired me when thinking about the design sprint process was this story that came out of Apple of Steve Jobs pitting two teams against each other to come up with the UI for mm-hmm. the iPhone. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be an iPod style UI, or is it going to be more of like a touchscreen style UI, like where you have like the apps?
Mm-hmm.
And those two competed against each other, and yeah. so he got to choose between two like well thought through, fleshed out prototypes. And that's great. If teams can start off in that way, then it's less about just the hunch of the leader.
Right.
And if your leader is not Steve Jobs, like you can have more confidence that they're on the right track, and it's better for the leader. That's right. good. And like to have everybody have the chance to put their solutions out there, to have people not have to make sales pitches yeah. and build, go off of their reputation or go off of how well they argue. All of those things are good for the feeling about those other teams. Like, you know, when the design team is in the room with the marketing team and they see that like, oh, when these people, they have good ideas.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
oh, the engineers also have good ideas. It's good for the designers who, as you say, oftentimes designers are not like these like perfect people. They have their own sort of like hang-ups or like arrogances. And it's really like super healthy to see all of the good things that your team brings to the table and to be in sort of this forced environment of respect yeah. in a good way. It's like really like, I think natural respect emerges from that process.
Yeah.
And then you have a foundation that I think is much, much different than what I experienced in many projects where you were just kind of thrown in and you kind of had to figure it out as you went. Mm-hmm. And one person had the authority or snagged kind of the authority away from everybody else and you weren't quite sure how they did it. And it was, and those are those frustrations. Just the more people are separate and the more it's political and the more it's like from the top down or unclear how decisions are made, that's not going to make people happy. And that's not over the long term going to yield good products. You can find always exceptions where products work in sure, that way, but sure. it's not always gonna happen.
Yeah, and then like the real reason of it probably is less about that team then and more like, let's say, the brand behind it.
Or yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. So now at this point, Jonathan's on his phone, so
just looking at the looking for a question to finish this off.
Oh yeah.
So every week, I ask our Instagram followers at AJ Smart Design to send in questions to the podcast. And oh dear God, I nearly knocked the microphone off the thing. And we'll just, I think that this question kind of requires a whole episode. So maybe let's just quickly
do it.
Coming up next week.
Actually, you know what? I'm not gonna ask that one because it is a full episode's worth of answer. Then let's go to.
How do you do John's hair?
Nanwood 50.
Ah, okay.
This is hello, Nanwood 50. And this is something also Michael mentioned before we started recording. This is just let's just answer this really quickly.
You read my mind, yeah. Nanwood. What is it?
How does the internet
when
work?
You finish,
what is that handle?
When you finish a design sprint,
yeah.
what do you do with the results?
just nothing.
Just burn nothing. Them. Yeah. Like, I mean, actually, that's an interesting one. Like, I guess that's a pretty broad question, but it could be, I mean, in the book, it doesn't really go into how you deliver that in turn. Like, you know, do you write a document or what do you do once the design sprint is finished?
Yeah, and I...
Can you sit a tiny bit?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll actually like to hear the way you guys deal with this, because...
Because you don't want to answer.
Because I don't, yeah, I'm just so tired of this podcast. No, but to be honest, like, in many of the cases, when I was doing a sprint with a startup, it was super easy because that team was, like, the whole team that was going to be working on the thing afterwards. Right. Or maybe it was the whole company, even. Right. And it's really easy. Like, everybody saw it. And the next week, we would get together. We would have a meeting maybe on Monday. We would have sort of everything had steeped kind of over the weekend. People slept on things a couple times. And then they would come back. We'd look at, these were the key questions we were trying to answer. You know, here's the summary of things that we came up with on Friday after we looked at the test results. Now let's talk about what we're going to do, what you guys are going to do next. Yeah. And a lot of times it was, we can totally see the gap between the prototype and like what we think people will understand and want. We want to update that prototype, test it again. We're not going to do a whole sprint. We're just going to do this kind of like half sprint.
Right.
And I think that's a really good pattern for all kinds of teams. But there always reaches this point where you're like, great, we've got confidence in the findings of this. We need to share it with other people. Yeah. And that's something where I feel like I know a little bit less well how to do it when you don't. Part of the design of the sprint process itself is to get the people in the room involved so that you don't have this like, oh, here's the document, here's the spec. Yeah. Like that's always like a weak point in your process. Absolutely. It gets to all of the things we were talking about that are bad, which is when somebody says like, here's the knowledge. And then you're like, you're skeptical of them or like whatever. Like that's to be avoided if possible. So I always wanted, when there was a bigger team, to get them like coming into the room a little bit during the sprint so that this wasn't a big like handoff moment.
Yeah.
And they felt like they knew what was going on before it came up. And you can even sometimes like crowd the room that's watching the tests as they go and have like a lot of people come in. And even if they don't come in for the whole day, but that's they just kind of come in for a few minutes and see, oh, this is what's going on. Like this isn't somebody off doing some weird product. Like I can actually see what's happening.
Actually, that happened even with our sprint this week. With the company really, really wanted to. We're working on a sprint, and it's probably been a topic with that company for a good few months for sure. And everybody kind of has this like working title of the project, but nobody really sees it, right? And the beauty of the sprint is that ideas now are suddenly tangible. It's just not some spreadsheet with lines and numbers about like the projected growth or profit that we're going to make, right? It's like, what is the thing that we're all creating, or what is that team there? And the user tests were beamed straight into like the HQ of the officer. Yeah. So everybody could see the end customer's reaction to some of these ideas. And I think that just, you know, brings everybody together and unites everybody and says, okay, no, we know where we're going now. We can see this thing tangibly. But I think there's a bunch of questions too. Sorry, our users.
Yeah, I mean, actually,
bunch of answers, because we've had experiences where, like you say, you work on the design sprint, you do, let's say, an iteration week, and what comes out of it, this prototype, okay, we don't go into like the setting screen or something like this, but the dev team are also in on that sprint.
Yeah.
And they literally took the prototype and implemented it. They could see where all the decisions had been made. They understood like the patterns, right? The kind of the UX patterns that were at play. The design was kind of already there, let's say the UI. So they could implement it. And then inside, like that was the fastest turnaround. It was like 1 month, whole new version of a whole app, right? And so that was super clear because, like you said, there was just not like we handed over this giant PDF. We definitely don't do anything like
that.
Love
those PDFs.
Yeah, because nobody really reads it, right? We do try to summarize every week. We know we offer that opportunity for people to always dial in and see the user tests, or at least try to give like the snippets in terms of the big ideas, right? Yeah. Like here's the feedback on the big ideas that you guys have been thinking about so far. So we don't really like go and do this like huge handover, but we do summarize things and try to give like at least 3 to 5 really tangible action steps that you could do next. And often the case is, right, this idea resonated, that huge idea that you thought was going to be the biggest feature of all time for this feature is meh, they weren't loving that. But if you just like tweak some things in this direction, you're going to get like a higher chance of success. And then, like you say, like feed that into an iteration week.
Yeah.
And then hopefully by the end of 2 weeks, I'd say 9 times out of 10, there is enough in the prototype and the user feedback to kind of hand that on to the internal design team to like go and make that thing real now and get it out there. But other times it depends what the business actually wants. You know, often it's just a case of design teams or product teams needing to unlock budget. So they now have a great prototype. They even have the validated kind of, proof that if we worked on this as a company, we could open up something. There could even be a new revenue stream. There could be a new business. We could disrupt stuff, and we have the proof for it. And it's much easier with this like tangible prototype and then user feedback that backs that up to unlock this budget. Yeah. So often it will depend as well, like we're saying, like what do you do with the result of a sprint? It will depend what the, you know, is it a product team that needs to get more budget so they can still work on an idea? Or is it really that this is going to go into production right now? So it depends what the organization wants to do as well, because I think there's so many great results that come out of a sprint.
I think actually I'll give like the bluntest answer then just to finish up so we get finished as quick as possible. A very common result that we would hand to the product team so that they actually kind of almost have a to-do list. Essentially, what we want to do at the end of the sprint is fill up their backlog with potential things that they could actually work on, and they can prioritize their backlog. But what we try to do is when we're working on the sprint, we're essentially looking at like a future vision for this possible product. So it might be that the thing we test in the design sprint is something that would take over a year to produce, potentially. So what we do is then we break that down into the individual features or individual user stories that are involved in that prototype, and we put them on an effort impact scale. You can Google effort impact scale if you're wondering, but it's basically a scale that shows you...
Effort and impact.
Effort and impact, exactly. It's like, how much effort will this thing take to create, and what would be the potential impact based on what the user tests were? And this way the company can kind of, the product team can help the development team or the product managers to actually prioritize what should be created based on the results of the sprint. And how we do that is essentially with the product team, we sit down, we write a simple report with some bullet points of what like the biggest outcomes of the tests were. And then we have this effort impact scale where we say, here's the recommended rollout plan in terms of what we actually should create first. And here's like maybe the 30 or 40% of the stuff that we should just ignore because it was just in the wrong direction. So we try to make, when an internal team does their design sprint, they should try to make sure, like one problem that actually happens, and I've seen this happen with internal product teams, is that they do the sprint and they don't have any way of integrating that into their normal processes. So they stop believing in doing the sprint because they're like, yeah, well, nothing came of it. So I think it is important that they explicitly have a system for adding it back into their own system. So whether they're doing a waterfall system or whether they have an agile system, they should definitely have a system for plugging in at least maybe just one feature or one user story back into their backlog. Otherwise, it's kind of a waste of time. And I've seen that happen as well.
I like your point on the effort impact scale, because the other thing you kind of notice, and this ties back just to close another full circle here.
We're never going to stop talking. Right?
By prioritizing things that are going to have a high impact for the end user, right? This is the stuff that also your product team want to work on, right? Otherwise, you're kind of doing these little... You know, you're pulling the results out and people start working on these tiny little tweaks and they're like, wow, really, what's going on? But if you put this thing up there and go, this is the big problem now that we've uncovered from this sprint, let's work on that. You'll probably find that you will solve all the other little you know, tweaks and fiddly bits along the way that doesn't really give your team this kind of like, well, I did some great work today or this week, you know, like it kind of like feeds into this, the momentum of the product team always kind of like pushing themselves and working on like problems or delivering results, at least to the rest of the business that means something, right? And give them this sense of achievement as well.
Yeah, I think that if you like look at what happens in the sprint and you can't get all the people in the room, one thing that's kind of cool about a sprint is that it's this like story structure is really strong in a sprint. It's kind of a mystery. And if you're in the room, you're like, like all the things we do on each day are, they're basically pretty simple. It's like, you start off, you need to make a map of what's going on and figure out what's going on with this project. Let's sort of map it out. Okay, what are some ways we can solve this problem? Let's sketch it out. What are the strongest of these? What do we think? What are our kind of our hunches or our bets about it? And then what would that solution look like? And then at the end, okay, like, are people going to actually like it? Are they going to be interested, excited about it? It's a mystery. It's just sort of a standard like mystery structure. It's like there's some kind of a problem. Here's some things. Here's some possible like suspects, you know, and we put together our hunch, and or we have maybe a couple of theories about what might be going on. And then at the end, like, oh, when you do the test, it's like the mystery is solved at the end. And you can tell that story. You can put like take photos as you're going through the sprint and pretty easily create this really interesting short story that you can tell people in like 5 or 10 minutes. And if you again, to give a pitch for the sprint book, but if you read the sprint book, there's a story about Blue Bottle Coffee. There's a story about Slack. There's a story about Flatiron Health. There's these other smaller stories about this company called FitStar, this company Foundation Medicine. A lot of those started as slide decks that I put together to tell the rest of the investing team at Google Ventures about sprints we were doing because they were curious about it. And it's just a plain English story. Yeah. Like, here's a question. Here's a challenge that this company has right now, this question they're trying to solve as they start this new project. Here are their hunches. Here's some sort of ideas. This was what they decided to test. Here's what they learned from their customers. You can tell that story inside your company, and it becomes this sort of like superhero origin story for your project. And that also gives people some confidence that what you're doing is not crazy, because there's no BS. If you look through that whole story, there's no weird like diagrams or weird like, oh, here's our, you know, proprietary like way of making a, you know, some personas or like journeys or whatever. It's just like plain English.
Yeah.
And people will look at it and be like, oh, okay, like that makes sense.
And that's what we do when we're our sprint's then 4 days, and every day there's just really like this photo diary of just actually what happened. We don't put our slant on it. We don't like try to do any like consulting stuff. Yeah. It's just like, this happened. These were where the dots went. These were the decisions. We worked on it. And that's what...
And I'm sorry about that picture. Just, I don't
know. Generally.
I really thought that was in my private collection.
Yeah. But no, it's totally like those... We're probably biased because we're super into it, but I think those stories are interesting. Yeah. Like, they're actually just like, they're short and interesting.
No, I don't like them. They're super
This
boring.
Podcast is going to be extended. Yeah.
Actually, I think what I realized is, in this episode as well is the... in episode one, probably people will notice that I'm way rowdier and louder in episode one. And now I feel the jet lag in this episode. It's like, because it's like darkness over my face where it's like, people are going to think I have some
stuff. Should we go and get coffee and wrap up this?
Yeah, I think we can wrap it up with one final question from Instagram, which I think we can really keep short. I know. But this is actually an interesting one, which...
this is an interesting
one. As opposed to...
Sorry, we were just rambling.
It has nothing to do with the design sprint. And I think it's something that actually I wish I had known the answer to this question, because I was super curious. What is Silicon Valley? And I think that this is something that I put a video on Instagram, I don't know, in February, after, as an Irish person, I can't say February.
Yeah, you really can't.
It's really hard. Say it? You say it?
February.
Yeah, that's terrible as well. So I put a video online where I kind of described what Silicon Valley is after I'd been there, because I was super confused about it. I was like, is it in San Francisco? Is it, what the hell is
it's not,
it?
Yeah.
It's not. I mean, it's basically... well, you've worked.
You should explain this. Yeah, we're foreigners.
Just break it down for
you. But in a funny way. We need to end this on a high note.
Well, okay. So there's San Francisco. It's on a little peninsula, and then there's what's like the Pacific Ocean on one side, the San Francisco Bay on the other side, big body of water. The South Bay area, south of that peninsula, is actually where Silicon Valley is, and it's like. It's like where historically, like Hewlett Packard was, like all these, you know, early sort of semiconductor companies. And there's like, if you go down there, if you've never been to Silicon Valley, if you've just heard that name, because I've only lived in this area for about 6 years. And before I started working at Google, which was 10, 11 years ago, I had never even really been to San Francisco, except as a kid. I had no concept of what was going on down here. If you hear the word Silicon Valley, in my mind, it was like Back to the Future 2 when they go into the future and there's hoverboards and it was like everything's glossy and it was like amazing. Or like if you've ever been to like Seoul, or like, you know, like you just picture like you know, like in Lost in Translation, when they're at they're in Tokyo, and like there's like giant like the screens on the buildings, and everything's like glass and shiny. That is what you would imagine, but when you actually go to Silicon Valley, you're not in San Francisco, which is cool and beautiful in its own way. You're in like literally like you're just like a lot of like buildings that were made in like the 60s, and they're just like two stories, three stories tall. They're squat. There's just like roads and like it's just like fast food restaurants. It's just like
it's suburbia. Like, for all the Australian listeners, it's not that different to how we grew up in the suburbs. Actually,
it's really weird. So visually, it's like way less impressive. I mean, if you go to like the Google campus, Facebook campus, like. If you go to the Apple campus, I think they'll shoot you. But if you go to like any of the other campuses, like it does look, you do have this feeling of like, oh, there's something special going on here. Sure. But a lot of these campuses even then like spread into these just like office park buildings.
Yeah.
And it's super boring.
Yeah.
So it's unmagical looking. But then there is also, when you come here, there is this other kind of magic that's real, which is that all these people from all around the world have moved here to do tech. And they're like really into it and really like legitimately excited about it. Mm. And so you can very quickly meet people who are doing all these interesting things, and everything is just like happening, and there's this intensity, and some, you know, there's like a more negative side of it. People are super competitive around here, but it's also like, it's just really exciting. And that's what makes Silicon Valley work, is that historically from the early days when they were making semiconductors and people were moving here to do that, this is where it all happens. And so this is where everyone for decades has been moving to do that stuff. The universities are strong in that stuff. There's big companies that people spin off and do startups, and that's why it's so famous still, but it's super boring.
And everybody drives a Tesla though, so
that's everybody, not everything, it's everybody except for me. We have like an old used Honda Accord, so we're really mocked by the locals.
But it's a good car. What's really interesting about it is we were staying in Palo Alto, which is where like Steve Jobs used to live and Mark Zuckerberg lives, and it's the ultimate, it's just the suburbs.
It's the ultimate suburb, but it's really nice.
It's crazy. It's really beautiful, but it's really like you're imagining these giant mansions. You still can't afford to live there. You can't afford to live there, But it's everything's very small, it's very cute, it's like just families with dogs, and it's like you expect, you know, I just expect it to be very techy. And the Googleplex is really nice, but it does look like my college that I went to. Like all these small, tiny buildings, which has like with a canteen, and it's very it's very cute.
I remember when I joined Google and went to go work. I was working on Gmail, and I go into the building. I'm like, oh man, I can't wait to see what the Gmail building looks like. And it's just like it was not at that time like on the main. Dungeon. It was like across the street from the cooler Google campus. Yeah, it was just like this office building. It's like acoustic tiles and like flickering. Right. Like this is the height of technology in the world. Yep.
People clapping, Jake blinking.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to episode 2 of the Product Breakfast Club.
Woo.
Yeah.
Live from San Francisco, even though I'm pretty sure you're not watching this live because it's fully impossible. This was fun, guys. It was very chilled. It was a chilled episode.
It was great to do it here in person with you.
Yeah.
As well. Not just like
why are we sitting here
on screen?
How do we get into Jake's house?
How did you guys get in here?
I don't know.
Well, we'll explore that.
Give me a key.
Episode 3.
Exactly. We had quite a few topics that we didn't get through, but we just go on very long. So, how can people find you online, Michael?
They can't.
Okay. Great.
Write me an email, though. michael@ajsmart.com.
Oh, that is old school.
Yeah,
that is Jake? Old school. I'm slightly less old school. You can find me on Twitter.
Woo!
So, at J-A-K-E-K, which is Jake K, not Jakek, as John
Jakek.
And you can find me on the most modern platform because I'm not an old man. You can find me on Instagram or Twitter, I suppose. You can also. Same handle. It's at J Ice Cream, which is J-I-C-E. Cream.
Ice cream. We had some great ice cream yesterday.
Oh my God, it was so good.
Okay, you guys, we got to have it.
We should.
Let's talk about this ice cream. All right, guys, thanks so much. Come back, subscribe, like it on YouTube if you're watching this on YouTube. Sorry about the audio. I mean, I'm sure that the audio is going to be not great.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. Look, give us 5 episodes. We're going to have great audio. Love you all. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Product Breakfast Club with Jake Knapp and Jonathan Courtney. You can check out past episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. We have many more great discussions coming soon. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please like, share, and leave us a review. The one thing that would really blow our minds is a 5-star review. Wow, that would be really nice. This podcast is produced by Kit, Brittany, and Patrick for AJ and Smart.